Grit? Merit? Bats? No way that's a better deal, Betsy. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From the HeckingerReport.org, new research finds that it hasn't gotten easier for poor kids to catch up. The kindergarten readiness gap between low-income and high-income students has not closed in a generation, even though parents are more involved than ever in their students' education and state-funded pre-K nutrition programs, and prenatal care are more accessible now than in the late 1990s.
And here is one of those where you go... And we're surprised.
Really? I mean, I read this headline. I'm like, well, yeah.
Okay. What you need to look at, though, here is this, there's a kind of a nuance in that where it says parents are more involved than ever. Okay.
Right.
That is a good thing.
Yeah.
And there's state-funded pre-K. There's nutrition programs. There's prenatal care. But the question, what it says is they're more accessible than they were in the 1990s. It doesn't say that people are actually taking advantage. Or the other issue here that when you get deep into reading this is that actually the income gap of between poor in the 1990s and what it means to be poor in 2017 is an extremely different poor.
Right.
So the comparison there, it almost, you sit there and go, well, I guess, duh, it makes sense. But it's even more makes sense from a kind of really pernicious point of view, which is, wow, we've made all these attempts to get nutrition down, to create pre-K, but we've done nothing while the income gap has actually grown. And so what it means to be poor in 2017 means it's more painful than it was in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where this story becomes a real discussion of public policy. Because if you get in there, parental care is up and it's helping.
Right.
All these things, research show, nutrition, early childhood make a difference. But it only makes a difference when income itself stays at a level that's supportive. When you have a reduction in the overall income level, in fact, it's harder to be poor now than it used to be. It's harder to raise your kids now than if you're poor.
Mm-hmm.
So here again, poverty, those who want to throw it out and say it's not an issue, poverty's a big issue.
From rawstory.com, education officials expect ineffective Betsy DeVos to step down as her agenda collapses. President Donald Trump's Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, is one of the most ineffective people to ever hold the job, say some insiders. And education officials are already starting to plan for a post-DeVos landscape when she is removed or steps down.
And let me tell you, the world out on social media of teacher social media, they are applauding, going nuts, looking at this, going, oh my God, heaven is actually opening its doors, which is kind of funny when you talk about Betsy DeVos, because she actually, in her mission for turning public schools, sees her mission to take public schools and help usher in the new kingdom of God. That aside, though, she's possibly quitting. She's pissed off.
Right.
Okay. Why? Well, because she's not used to not being able to do whatever the hell she wants.
Right. It's like you and I were talking about when you go from a business that's not publicly held to all of a sudden this is government.
Right.
What did she say? She's not used to the time, patience, and government savvy of the job.
Right.
That's all that job is.
What part did you not understand when you signed up for the job that it was a government job? Okay. I, though, want to caution people. I'm not all that excited as other people are about Betsy DeVos stepping down, because the reality is that her boss is not stepping down.
Right.
Okay. And so whether it's Betsy DeVos or not, I got to go back to her boss, and we'll say it here on the Busted Pencils. President Trump has not been one to pick favorable people towards public education.
Mm-hmm.
And so my guess is that when Betsy steps down, if she steps down,
if
as they're saying, the celebration is going to be short-lived because there are a lot of crappy people, just like Betsy DeVos, who can't wait to try their turn at being in charge, however, when they're not really.
The grass isn't always greener.
Time for Tim to rant. This is Someone Has to Say It.
Are you kidding me? A better deal? From Ian Haney Lopez at BillMoyers.com, the Democratic Party is, number one, a party of swamp creatures. Number two, a party afraid of equality. Three, a boring party with limited ambitions. And four, a party on a new marketing kick. Not really sensing the love there, are you? And how about this from Stephen Thrasher over at The Guardian? Quote, 6 months into Donald Trump's term and Democrats' ability to be an opposition party is, in a word, pathetic, end quote. I know it's a little beating around the bush, but I get the sense that Mr. Thrasher is a bit disappointed in the Dems, too. But why? Aren't the Democrats the party of bold ideas? You know, that New Deal? You know, social justice warriors, human rights advocates. Hey, according to Hannity and Limbaugh, that's exactly who they are. But if you happen to be just a plain old Democratic voter, you're probably thinking more like Lopez and Thrasher. The party and its elite leadership are too busy sucking... Wait, that's Scaramucci's line on Bannon. Hold on. How about this? For regular Democrats, the party just doesn't quite know how to party anymore. But hold the phone. Senator Chuck Schumer was just seen leaving a telephone booth in red underwear. What? I know what you're thinking, but I'm sorry. People still know what red underwear look like. Phone booths? Maybe not so much. Anyway, according to the eyewitnesses, the Democratic senator had a New York Times op-ed in hand. What say the op-ed? How about a better deal? That's right. The Democrats are offering a better deal with a realization that the party may not have been very responsive to the needs of regular voters. In fact, according to Senator Schumer, quote, Democrats have too often hesitated from taking on those misguided policies directly and unflinchingly, so much so that many Americans don't know what we stand for. Not after today. Democrats will show the country that we're the party on the side of working people and that we stand for three simple things. Democrats will propose policies to increase people's pay, reduce everyday expenses, and provide workers with tools for the modern economy. As my friend Jonathan Pelto would say, wait, what? Dems are going to increase my pay, reduce my expenses, and give me tools. You want to hear that again? Increase, reduce, tools. How's that for a better deal? WTF, right? No boldness, no human rights, no social justice. Just BS words meant to calm the peasant class. Because that's the reality, isn't it? Schumer and the Democratic leadership haven't got a damn clue about what it's like to live paycheck to paycheck with a sick kid in braces and one about to go to college while paying off student loan expenses. Hey, that's just me. I'm living the dream. But what about those that are truly the least of these? No effing clue. Better deal from the Democrats? As Al from Tool Time used to say, I don't think so, Tim. But hey, let's not forget, this is also the party that couldn't even stop the confirmation of an unqualified billionaire who hates public schools from becoming the Secretary of Education. You know, come to think of it, there's been a lot of blame hoisted on Trump people for DeVos. But let's be honest. With strategies like a better deal, isn't it really the fault of the Democrats? You know, I wonder what Matt Damon's mom thinks.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
So, Nancy, what? Diane Ravitch has a new piece out about the fact that Betsy DeVos and the reason she's here, Democrats.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, it's Republicans and Democrats. It's just that the Democrats paved the way for her.
So you're okay. You're okay with that position. That
100%.
Okay.
100%. I believe. I'm absolutely. Yeah. I've just put my boxing gloves on for this one. this situation that we're in, we're in it because the Democrats sold out on public education, and they really betrayed the people and their core values. For equity and for equal educational opportunity for all children, they gave it up. It started with Bill Clinton. He started talking about national achievement and testing. And then when we got to Obama, some of us were hoping mm-hmm. although I always feared it, but hoping that there would be a reverse in what we'd seen with, you know, the testing and choice agenda. And then, you know, he really doubled down on the whole thing with Race to the Top. It was heartbreaking and shocking. I've never recovered from it, and I haven't understood what happened there. It must be, and in that article, Diane Ravitch tries to lay out a few different motives. I mean, there are probably multiple motives. I mean, why did they sell out on public education? Did some of them actually believe that the choice model was going to benefit all kids? I don't see how you could if you understand how it works.
Well, it made no sense. And I remember, you know, again, as I said, this bipartisan. And as you said, we can go back to Clinton. We can go, you know, with Goals 2000 and easily trace this.
Right.
You know, what I've seen, some of the criticism of Diane's article has been, you know, well, you know, they really hammered her hard, and they voted really hard to try to keep her out of being Secretary of Education. And it's like, well, wait, you're missing the point. We're not saying that those Democrats, and, well, you know, it wasn't that hard to hit somebody so unqualified at the point, but it's the paving the way for the idea of somebody like Betsy DeVos that I think a lot of people were missing here. And that's, you did a really nice, you know, nice job by tracing this back. But I think about this, you know, bipartisanship,
yeah.
No Child Left Behind there was back slapping, you know, probably shots being thrown over mm-hmm. shoulders with Democrats and Republicans. I mean, it was, you know, the earth was about to crack. I mean, there had never been such bipartisanship on No Child Left Behind. And
now what you see with Trump and DeVos in their education policy, it's an easy next step. It's a natural next step from everything that has led to this point. And that's on Obama, and that's on Clinton, and of course it's on the Republicans. And I will say, too, on a lot of progressive Democrats who have not spoken out on education nearly the way they should have. Bernie starts making some sounds now, but it's way too late.
They were
always too afraid to come out and really speak the truth about this. They never wanted to take it on. And they didn't want to go against Obama either.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
She is the first executive director of the Center for Artistry and Scholarship and has taught at the Harvard Graduate School of Education for 15 years. She served as founding headmaster of the Boston Arts Academy, Boston's only public high school for the visual and performing arts. She is the current author of When Grit Isn't Enough, A High School Principal Examines How Poverty and Inequality Thwart the College for All Promise. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Linda Nathan.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, before we get into the book, which is awesome and amazing, and I'll just say that right now,
Thank you.
The Boston Arts Academy, you were the headmaster, the founding headmaster. Just
yes,
a quick description, what goes on, what happened there, how did that start?
Well, I have a background in the arts, and I had been at Fenway High School for 14 years as the co-director, one of the first alternative high schools and pilot high school, and I had always taught theater there. I had also helped to start a middle school for the arts, and when the opportunity came to start a school where kids would actually vocationally do the arts as well as their academics, I jumped at the chance to found this wonderful high school. So the kids have five majors: vocal, instrumental music, those are separate majors, theater, dance, visual arts, and then, of course, a huge complement of academic classes as well.
And according to the statistics that a lot of people read, you've been extremely successful with college acceptance rates.
Yes, indeed.
Above, not right, all those numbers. But it's interesting because you kind of took those numbers and did a deeper dig to really look at college and the alumni of the students, which brings us to the book, When Grit Isn't Enough. And I just laid out, you put it out there in one way, kind of five
ways that we might want to re-examine some of the things that we talk about. And it's money doesn't have to be an obstacle. Race doesn't matter. Just work harder. Everyone can go to college. And if you believe, your dreams will come true. And at least according to some of your students, we need to re-examine those positions.
Right. As I stepped down from being the headmaster of the Boston Arts Academy, and Clark, who's the current headmaster, I asked what could I do to support her in the transition. And she said, interview the alums, see how they're thinking about their time here. And the book really emerged from that. I didn't know I was writing a book. I thought I was just interviewing young people. But I interviewed over 80, formally 80 young people. And then I probably talked to, 20, 30 more informally. And those myths that you just read are the things that came out again and again in the interviews. And in some ways, you have to have air quotes when you say them.
Right.
That's the point, that kids would recount stories to me, much of what I chronicle in the book, about what an incredible obstacle money has been. And, the book was really written during Obama's presidency. It was finished during Trump's, election, but, before it, really. And the idea that we are somehow a colorblind society where race doesn't matter just came out so loud and clear from kids of color and white students talking about how important diversity is to them, how little they really thought their campuses were doing around race, and then this notion of grit, which has been so popularized with our no excuses schools, just, that took me in a really interesting direction because, we have this idea in our country, just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Mm-hmm. If you work hard, you'll be successful. Well, it turns out, structural systemic racism stands in the way of that. And I think, the wake-up call, in some ways for me, was recognizing that we can do more, we must do more, and we must build better bridges between high school and college for our first generation kids and our kids of color who, if colleges accept them, which we want them to, they got to support them.
Well, and that's what's really interesting about the book is because we examine the myths, but what I like though is that there's a constant commentary in here about what we can be doing to do better.
Right.
And so it's not just a complaint, the five myths.
No,
it's these myths, and you illustrate them wonderfully with classic interviews of a student. So, for example, I'll just mention Raul in Money doesn't have to be an obstacle. You put forward, he gets a full scholarship and is totally excited about this.
Right.
But
right.
the reality of his lived experience was the short side of it was not realizing that it didn't mean that he had living expenses covered.
Right, right. And people hear that story and say, well, how come you didn't tell him? How come he didn't know? But I use these stories as, if you will, sort of iconic stories to get us to understand Raul is not an exception. Mm-hmm. There are many, many Rauls out there. And if it wasn't about housing, it would be about, I missed one email, and I tell those stories, and then I lost my financial aid, or I had to whatever. And, the kinds of things that middle-class kids do not have to deal with.
Right, and again, though, it's not to say that, these are things that should be stopping, but that we do have ways, as you just even said, even simply recognizing, why didn't we tell Raul about the fact that when he got a, quote, full academic scholarship, Raul, we also need to remind you that there is going to be a housing and how are you going to live? How are you going to get there? How are you going to decorate your room? How are you going to do all those things? All those things, as you said, some middle-class white people, middle-class anybody might take for granted. And so that, we come back at that and look at that. So roll is a great one. And then you're just to stay on roll for this segment here, when he decided he could live with his brother in New Jersey, talking about the fact that when he realized that, my brother in New Jersey is actually like at least more than 2 hours away on a drive. Those are things we don't think about.
And I don't tell the story to beat myself up or beat my faculty up or even beat Raul up. I tell the story, as I said, because he's actually not an exception. And, you know, what happened to him is he ended up taking, in the moment, because he was going to college, he ended up taking out loans. And those loans, of course, sank him because he couldn't continue to do that. And those are the kinds of things I think we forget, that in somewhat invisible web of inequity that some kids live with and other kids do not. I mean, I tell another story in the book that seems sort of straightforward, but Ashley ends up dropping out of school because her grade point average goes below what it needs to be to keep her scholarship, because she has to stay with all her courses, but her middle-class counterparts can drop organic chem and take it in the summer because they can pay for it. She cannot.
Right.
So, you know, these are the kinds of things that happen again and again and again to my kids that we don't talk about. So I do try to give some solutions for that at the end of that chapter that I think are kind of, I don't know if they're obvious, but I do think the whole question of releasing of transcripts, that's in college's control.
Sure. There's a lot we can do. In fact, when we come back on 1510 AM Resistance Radio, we will talk more with Linda specifically about some of the things that we can do to help students get away from this idea that schools can be successful for all students, but what we need to do. We are talking to Linda Nathan, the author of When Grit Isn't Enough. Linda, we were talking last about some of the solutions, particularly to this question or this myth that money doesn't have to be an obstacle, and the fact that maybe even a simple solution can be just simple awareness and helping students understand the financial responsibilities that come with going to college. And so it's one thing to get them ready for college in their minds, but another thing to actually prepare them. I want to move, though, on to another one that I think is at the heart of the book, this just work harder myth,
right?
And the idea put in there, particularly grit, because it's in the title of the book, so let's talk about it. What do you mean? If I work hard enough, why can't I succeed?
Right. Well, some people can. And, you know, what I would say is if you don't work hard, you won't succeed. But just because you do work hard does not mean you will succeed. And what I try to describe in the book are some pretty amazing young people who had more grit, if you will, than anyone I know. But because one was undocumented, you know, another, you know, lost her scholarship, you know, on and on and on, grit just wasn't enough. So I'm sort of taking on this Angela Duckworth grit psychology that has been so popularized by the No Excuses schools, and saying, you know, first of all, I think it's a racist philosophy, and second of all, the way it's been promulgated, not the actual psychology of grit, but the way it's been used as a pedagogy ends up being interpreted, and I visited schools that were, you know, grit schools, where 98, 99, 100% of the students are black and brown, and almost 100% of the faculty are white. And the kinds of practices I saw were literally out of the 1950s.
Right. Keep your eyes on me, follow me at all times, right?
Yeah, and if you laugh, if you giggle, you know, we're going to absolutely not do the video. We're not going to do the fun stuff because we're going to go silent to the cafeteria. Mm-hmm. And I want the American public to know this is going on much more often than we think these days, and it's not going on with your kids or my kids, who are middle-class kids, because we would never allow our kids to be in that kind of a setting.
Right.
So I really question, first of all, I question whether those are the kids, that's the way we want to raise up a whole generation of people. You know, and secondly, I really want to ask, is this good?
Well, it makes, like you said, some really tough, really racist assumptions as
right.
the idea that this is what these kids need,
right.
But the rest of us don't. And so,
right.
you know,
right.
we're there, it's grit, it's kip, it's just work
right.
harder.
Right, right.
Okay, but then let's get to the end, though. Can I believe, though? Can I have a dream, Linda? Please, can you at least give me the dream?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
The last chapter is about some of the wonderful, wonderful kids that we've taught and that are doing amazing things, some of them quite famous. And what I talk about in that chapter is student voice and agency and artists as activists. And I don't just talk about Boston Arts Academy. I also talk about some other schools that really have understood that when you put kids at the center of their own learning, as the researchers, as the ethnographers, something unbelievable happens. I, of course, think the best way to do it is through an artistic lens, but I think you can also work through a social justice lens. And I think when we ask kids to actually make and do, that their education really can change. So I try to give some examples at the end about, you know, what it is to soar and to dream as a young person and what kind of triumphant stories I tell. I think some just wonderful stories to celebrate, but I don't want us to say, well, if they did it, others can do it too.
Well, I mean, you talk about that, you know, we need to be careful, and this is, quote, holding up the exception as the rule,
right.
And be
right.
careful of that. But at the same time, to celebrate, what I really liked about this chapter was the emphasis, and you said this a few seconds ago, on the social justice and activism.
Right.
In fact, I wrote down there this idea as artists as activists.
Right, right.
And I have
a section, you know, called that about
right.
how my students end up seeing themselves that way, which is just they see themselves as change makers. You know, they may be living in one reality, but we've given them the skills to create a different reality, and that's what school should be about.
And that's the come back then where you begin the book in talking about how important the future of democracy
right.
is in
right.
this. And so
right.
remind people there of you know, the beginning, which is your fear for democracy.
Well, I fear that if we have just these grit, no excuses kind of schools where everything is about behavior and match me, not that that's bad. You need some of that. But what we really need is diversity of opinion, diversity of thought, and for schools to be places where kids can literally muck about. And I worry so much that as we go on to the grit, you know, pathway, we forget about the importance of making mistakes. We forget about creativity. We do double English, double math, and think that just by having the, you know, flags of the colleges on our doors, that will be enough. But I think it's through creative making and making schools be places of play and creativity that we'll create a democracy that we can all be proud of.
Well, the book is When Grit Isn't Enough, A High School Principal Examines How Poverty and Inequality Thwart the College for All Promise. We've been talking with the author of that book, who was the principal, Linda Nathan. Linda, as we say here, thanks for busting pencils with us today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks, Tim. It was a pleasure.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
She is a badass teacher. She's from Florida. She is Teacher Joe. Welcome to Busted Pencils. What's going on with your life? Because you posted something that now people can go to bustedpencils.com. I am a teacher for now. And I just want to read the first part of this. And I'm going to quote Teacher Joe. "Sorry in advance for the length, but I need to get this out. After 22 years, I don't know if I have it in me anymore. I'm a teacher. I will always be a teacher. I love teaching, but this isn't teaching." And it goes on and goes on and goes on. What's going on in Teacher Joe's life?
Well, this school year has been unusually stressful. It just seems like the demands that have been placed upon us, the amount of paperwork to document every last thing we're doing, has become unbelievably excessive to the point where it is taking me away from what is at the heart of my teaching, which is planning for my students. And I had just come off a weekend where I spent literally every waking hour, save for doing laundry and cooking meals, writing plans and doing paperwork and making centers. And there was just no time for my life. And then something happened on Monday where I received a walkthrough from my principal, and the comment that I received in the one area where I was given a level of basic in or on the Danielson rubric, it was just an inane comment and not reflective of my teaching at all. And it just made me realize that education has become a game. And it, you know, the teachers are playing the game, the principals are playing the game, and the ones who are making the rules, our legislators, know nothing about how to play the game. So we're, you know, we're puppets who are dancing to their tune, and unfortunately, it's creating a disaster for our students, our teachers, and ultimately our communities.
Describe a walkthrough for our listeners.
You know, typically we think of teacher evaluations as being very formal observations where you write up a lesson plan, submit it, you meet with the principal beforehand, they come observe the lesson, you meet with the principal afterwards for a post-observation conference. And the funny thing is I've never been a big fan of that because anybody can put on a show. You know, I've always said, feel free to walk into my room anytime because that's when you get a good sense of what I do. So that's really the model that our district has moved to and a lot of other districts are. They just pop in at a random time, and they may be looking for certain components of the either Danielson or Marzano, whichever your district is using. Danielson.
Yeah, when you say Danielson and Marzano, these are essentially guides that a principal would use to look at your teaching practice and say, Teacher Joe is using the Danielson framework appropriately, or actually in your case, averagely, in an average way.
Right.
Okay, so a principal walks through Teacher Joe's room, walks out, and you find in your mailbox your evaluation on the Danielson as average after spending the entire weekend laundry, occasionally a little bit of food for your kid here and there, but preparing your butt off for the day, and you're average.
Right.
Okay.
And I was literally just left with the feeling of, what am I doing this for? Because what I'm doing isn't even authentic anymore. It's, you know, I'm jumping through the hoops that somebody tells me I have to jump through. And I'm not even so sure it's for my students' benefit anymore. It's to prove something. And I'm not so sure I even know what it is we're supposed to be proving or to whom we're supposed to be proving it. But I'm at the point where I ask myself, why am I doing this? If it's not in the best interests of my students, if, you know, I said in my post that I can see their blank faces with their eyes glazed over. There's no joy in it for them, and if there's no joy in it for them, how can there be any joy in it for me?
Well, that's a tough question, because that seems to be at the heart of a lot of teachers I talk to. One of the reasons I picked this up is because you, in these few paragraphs, were able to capture what I hear time and time again from teachers, which is this sense of going, you know, what's the use? What am I doing? How much longer? But it's frightening, because you have 22 years in. You have advanced degrees?
Yes, I have 2 master's degrees.
You have 2 master's degrees, and you're average.
Right.
Okay. Now, people would say, well, there's nothing wrong with being average. You could be poor. But the reality is, though, with this average rating, just so people understand, in Florida, is that this also is tied to a merit-based pay system.
Correct. So we actually have 4 rankings. For the purposes of using the Danielson rubric, we get scored as either unsatisfactory, basic, proficient, or distinguished.
Okay, and you got, I'm sorry, you're basic.
In one domain. Everything
right.
else on that walkthrough came out proficient. And then, you know, on previous walkthroughs, there were things where I was given distinguished.
Okay.
But then this combines with our VAM score, which is, again,
your value-added measurement, which takes in
exactly.
your... Right, okay.
Some, you know, formula that some statistician came up with that nobody understands.
Right.
So that contributes 33% to... Yeah, that's 33% of our final evaluation, and then the principal's part is the other 67%. And we get a final... we get a final rating of either highly effective, effective, needs improvement, or unsatisfactory. And those are the designations that the state of Florida uses. If you are unsatisfactory or needs improvement overall, you get no raise. If you are effective or highly effective, you get some raise that gets negotiated between local associations and local boards.
But, so at the heart of this, when I read through everything here, and again, I recommend everybody go to BustedPencils.com and read your post, I am a teacher for now, but it's the inauthenticity,
yeah.
As a PhD, I can make up my own words, that as you say, is draining. It's a game, you talk about this. I want to know, though, I mean, how close are you to when you say, for now, I'm a teacher, I always will be, I love it, but this isn't teaching. Is there an exit strategy you're thinking about?
I look and see, because my heart will always be with education, I don't think I could just pick up and, you know, go work in marketing, or because that's not who I am. If there was a way for me to stay in education, whether it's as, you know, an advocate or an activist, something where, or training teachers, working with new teachers, but something that would give me the chance to make a positive difference, I would probably do it in a heartbeat.
Well, at this point, there is no money in those things that you just laid out, and to support the family, you're going to have to either stay a teacher, but I worry about this, Teacher Joe. I worry about what you've essentially captured here as being very generalizable to the majority of teachers in this country, and I put in my own little part to the end of this blog where I said, and we wonder why we have a teacher shortage. Teacher Joe, listen, hang in there as much as you can. Thank you for writing. And more importantly, though, thanks for busting pencils.
Thank you, Tim.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
From time to time, we are lucky enough to have education author Alfie Cohn join us for Cohn's Zone. Today,
Alfie is here to take on merit pay for teachers. Alfie, does merit pay really work for teachers?
Okay, let's back up and ask whether money is what teachers care most about. Surveys show that even though a lot of teachers would like to be better paid, that's not what drives them. It's not what drives them to be great, and it's not the absence of money that's the primary contributor to their dissatisfaction. More often, teachers are likely to complain about being over-controlled and turned into test prep technicians, where the whole goal is to raise test scores, for example, and implement somebody else's standards. So ask the question, who benefits from the view that money is what most teachers care about? But, you know, what makes this more complicated, almost comical, is that the people who talk about paying, that pay is what matters to teachers, aren't just proposing a raise for them. Well, let's give them more money.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they're saying, let's treat them like pets. Let's turn money into a doggy biscuit and make them jump through hoops to get paid more money. That's what merit pay is, pay for performance. And pay for performance or merit pay plans have a horrible track record. What's really interesting is that fans of this approach, which typically include conservatives, economists, and conservative economists, those are the three big groups,
okay,
say, trust us, this time by tweaking the process and the details of implementation, we'll get the merit pay right. But merit pay always ultimately fails and creates new problems, not because of the design of a particular version of it, but because of the whole set of assumptions about learning, about teaching, about motivation on which the concept is based.
So the other thing I hear in this, though, too, you started this, and I thought you were headed there, is this, and we were coming back, there's the compliance part built into this, too, isn't there? I look at this and say, we'll give you more money if you do what we say.
Oh, absolutely. Or to put it differently, merit pay, by definition, is about control of teachers by people who have more power than teachers. The sad irony is that a lot of teachers who are pissed off about this, understandably resentful, then turn around and do behavior management programs with their students that reflect the same top-down disrespectful approach. But we'll put that aside for another week.
Sure.
It is absolutely about control. And the worst version is when you offer to pay them more for not compliance in the sense of becoming imaginative facilitators of learning who help kids think more deeply and love what they're doing. No, the criterion, as with your example at the beginning in your question, for getting more money is to raise scores on terrible tests, which actually can often go hand in hand with lowering the quality of real learning, because standardized tests measure what matter least. And we have loads of research on that. You and I have talked about that before.
Sure.
But here I want to get to a point that's much more fundamental. It's not just how you design the merit pay plan, and it's not even what the criterion is for getting the extra bonus. Any merit pay is problematic because it is an example of not only control, but an extrinsic motivator. Do this and you'll get that. And we have scores and scores of studies in workplaces, classrooms, families, and other arenas that show the more you reward people for doing something, the more they come to lose interest in whatever they had to do to get the reward. So we want teachers to be paid well and fairly, and then to put money out of their minds. Because if a teacher, like, by the way, anybody else who works for a living, if a teacher comes to work in the morning and says, what do I have to do to get more in my paycheck, that you've lost that teacher.
Right.
Now the teacher sees teaching and learning as a means to an end.
When I always think about this from the merit pay thing of about a teacher who, when you put them in that situation, when they're recognizing that we haven't paid them enough, that they're almost actually teaching at a point where it's a survival. And how could that be best for kids when teachers are paid to a point that they actually have to compete for pay so that they have pay to actually make ends meet?
Well, there's two issues there we should tease apart. One is not paying them enough, and I agree they in most cases should be paid more, although, as I said a moment ago, that's not the critical issue that predicts job satisfaction.
Sure, right.
But the competition is, in fact, you put your finger on one of the unique disadvantages of merit pay, which is that it actively discourages collaboration among teachers and also among schools. Because if I'm thinking about how am I going to make more money, I'm not focused on what we can do as a faculty or as a profession to learn from one another. And people start sniping at each other, undercutting each other, and trying to game the system to figure out how they can get the money. You know, the basic assumption that underlies merit pay, it occurred to me some years ago, is the following belief. Teachers could be doing a better job, but they've decided for some reason to withhold those efforts until we bribe them out of them. So in other words, we're not going to look at structural problems. We're not going to look at systemic barriers to improving schools and dealing with our problems. We're going to actively distract people's attention from the structural barriers and say, and we're saying this tacitly, implicitly, by the very existence of a merit pay program, the problem is the teachers. And the problem is that the teachers aren't doing what they already know how to do and could do without any help and without any more resources. But apparently they think we've got to dangle more money in front of them before they'll do it. I mean, that is as inaccurate as it is insulting.
From Cone's Zone to Cone's famous question. Taking it on this week, Allison McDowell, parent activist and blogger at Wrenching the Gears. Allison, what are the schools our children deserve?
Our children deserve schools with human teachers, where they can learn with each other, where they have access to a full curriculum that respects them as people and individuals and that doesn't track them and slot them into some slot to serve the global economy.
Now our nod to activist and historian Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zen.
If you join a fight for social justice, you may win or lose, but just by being part of the struggle, you win, and your life will be better for it.
My thanks to Matt's mom, Linda Nathan, Teacher Joe, Alfie Cone, Allison McDowell, and you. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Thanks for busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.